From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, veteran war correspondent Scott Anderson reflects on why he spent years reporting from war zones and why so many young men seem attracted to war as life's ultimate test. After filing from Lebanon, Northern Ireland, Sri Lanka, and Chechnya, Anderson has written a novel about a journalist wounded in war. Also, we talk with journalist Nina Burley about her new biography of Mary Meyer, one of JFK's lovers while he was in the White House. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton says Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic has 4 days to live up to his promise to comply with United Nations demands on Kosovo or face a swift military response from NATO. Milosevic has agreed to withdraw Serb forces from the province and end attacks against ethnic Albanians there. But Mr. Clinton has expressed skepticism about the deal, saying in his words, "Balkan graveyards are filled with President Milosevic's broken promises." The man who brokered the deal, U.S. Envoy Richard Holbrooke, agreed, saying it's too early to celebrate. White House negotiators are due to return to Capitol Hill this afternoon for another round of budget talks with congressional leaders. The two sides have narrowed their differences on a number of fronts and could finish their work as early as tomorrow, as NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The prospects of replenishing International Monetary Fund coffers with $18 billion are looking up as Republicans in the White House near agreement on the conditions the GOP wants attached to the money. Another big stumbling block, whether to allow sampling techniques in the 2000 census, has been put off for 6 months. Both sides have agreed on the need for more education spending, but Republicans want school districts to have more of a say. Hawaii Democratic Congresswoman Patsy Mink doesn't want to give local officials the chance to divert the funds.
I plead with the Republican majority to do as they have been saying on the floor every day. Put those monies for the teachers right in the classrooms. Don't fund it in any sort of circuitous way where we don't know how that money is getting to our schools.
Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
5 scientists at American universities have won this year's Nobel Prizes for Physics and Chemistry for their work in exploring the inner structure of matter. 3 physicists will share the prize for research into the behavior of electrons. And the Nobel Prize in Chemistry goes to 2 researchers who pioneered the use of computers in chemistry. Their work helped open a thriving field of research. NPR's Richard Harris has more.
Chemical reactions obey the laws of physics, since chemicals, after all, are made of atoms. But the laws of physics are so complicated, it's tough to use them to calculate how chemicals will behave. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences honored 2 scientists who pioneered methods to compute chemical reactions. Walter Cohn, now at the University of California in Santa Barbara, will share this year's Nobel Prize with John Popiel at Northwestern University. The techniques they developed are used extensively in everything from drug development and astronomy to understanding the inner structure of matter. The Nobel Committee also announced that the Physics Prize will be shared by Robert Laughlin, Horst Stermer, and Daniel Tsui, who studied the physics of electrons at Bell Labs. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is now down 27 points at 7,974 in active trading. On the NASDAQ, the composite index is down about 24 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, a number of major companies are releasing their third-quarter earnings reports today, and by and large, the earnings news is not especially rosy. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
From General Motors to the Wall Street brokerage business of Merrill Lynch, the numbers for the 3 months ending in September are grim. GM, hurt by the effects of a lengthy strike at 2 of its key parts plants earlier in the summer, says it lost $809 million during the third quarter. Merrill Lynch says its earnings also fell sharply. The brokerage posted a net loss of $164 million during the quarter and says it will lay off 3,400 employees. That's roughly 5% of its workforce. One bright spot in the dismal earnings parade, film and photography giant Kodak says its third quarter earnings rose to $398 million. Monsanto and American Home Products also announced today they're calling off their $33.5 billion merger on the grounds the two could not agree on who would control the merged company. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Merrill Lynch is not the only brokerage firm reporting lower earnings today. Payne Weber says its net income fell 27% in the third quarter compared to the same period last year. The company's shares, though, are trading slightly higher today. Healthcare giant Johnson & Johnson said its third quarter profits rose more than 12%. That met Wall Street's expectations as strong U.S. drug sales offset weakness in Johnson & Johnson's medical device and consumer products division. Safeway is buying Dominick's supermarkets for $1.2 billion in cash. Dominick's a major supermarket chain in the Chicago area. If the deal is completed, Safeway would end up with nearly 1,500 stores located in 18 states and parts of Western Canada. As part of the transaction, Safeway would assume $646 million of Dominick's debt. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
Support for NPR comes from Tor Books, publisher of Robert Jordan's The Path of Daggers, available wherever books are sold starting October 20th.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. War is hell, but as my guest Scott Anderson says, for many young men, war has always been an adventure of intense fascination, viewed as life's ultimate test, its most awful thrill. Anderson confesses that he first went to war because he thought it would be exciting. He didn't go as a soldier, but as a journalist. He has filed from Beirut, Sri Lanka, Uganda, Chechnya, and Northern Ireland. He co-wrote with his brother John Lee Anderson, War Zones, an oral history of modern war. Now Scott Anderson has written a new novel called Triage, about a photojournalist who is wounded in war, wounded physically and psychologically. The novel is filled with Anderson's reflections about how war changes people. Let's start with a reading from the novel. The photojournalist has been wounded in Kurdistan. He regains consciousness in a cave that functions as a guerrilla hospital with no running water and no medicine. Dr. Talzani is making his way down the rows of wounded, performing triage.
Triage. Mark had already seen it, photographed it. He felt fatigue wash over him, push him down towards sleep. He shook his head violently to keep it at bay. To be alert, that was the important thing. You had to be alert when Talzani came for you, because triage was done quickly. If you were asleep when he came, if you were too slow with your answers, these could be taken as signs and the blue plastic tag placed on you. Your fate decided by the color of plastic. Get a yellow and be shunted aside. Get red and be treated. Get blue and die. On several occasions, when Mark had been a photographer in Harir instead of a patient, he had seen those given blues beg Talzani, cry to him, offer him money and houses and wives, but the doctor was incorruptible. He turned to see the white coat draw nearer, just 7 or 8 beds away. The dark at the edge of his eyes grew, took more and more of his vision.
Scott Anderson, I'm wondering if you were ever wounded, and if you ever experienced firsthand triage in a war zone.
Well, I haven't seen to quite the dramatic degree in it that's in the novel, but certainly I've been in situations where after a battle, basically what triage refers to is a term the French came up with, which is a sorting out of war wounded into 3 categories: those that can't be saved, those that need medical attention right away to be saved, and those that can wait, who can be dealt with when time permits. The problem with those three neat categories is there's a floating scale, and it of course it all depends how you grade people, depends on the sort of time you can give them. So, in a situation where somebody has a wound that might take 2 hours for a doctor to in order to save their life, what happens to that person when a whole new batch of wounded come in and they don't have 2 hours to work on him? Well, what happens is he gets shunted aside to die. So the triage, the three categories, tends to be this very fluid grading system. And certainly in situations I've been in, I've seen situations where in a different circumstance somebody could have been saved, but the decision's made that just because of the time factor involved, how long that person would take to be saved, they can't be.
Were you ever wounded while covering the war?
No, I haven't.
Did you have friends who were close to who were wounded or killed?
I've known several people who've been killed, but not really close friends, and usually photographers, but not anyone who was very close to me. No.
Yeah, and the character in your novel is a photographer. Do you think photographers are more likely to get wounded than print journalists are?
Statistically, they are. They're much more likely to be wounded, and I think it's endemic to the profession. They always, when something happens, they want to be right up front. And I think there's a funny sort of psychological thing happens to them. I've always been struck at how differently photographers seem to experience war than reporters. I think that there's a funny detachment that sets in with photographers, that the world becomes almost like a movie passing in front of their eyes, and they're able to be rather dispassionate, at least for the short term. And everything's is just a series of images, a series of frames in front of their eyes. And I think because reporters are so much more involved in those places, in the landscape, you're interviewing people, you're schmoozing people, that you don't have that remove. And I think that's why so many photographers get killed. I think that I've been aware at times working with photographers that where it seems to me that they really have no concept of just of how dangerous something is, and they just keep going forward. Where, reporters sitting back and looking all around, not just through a viewfinder, think, it's time to go back.
The main character in your novel is haunted by a wounded friend who cries, "Save me, save me." And I think those words are very potent to you. You have a story in which someone was saying to you, "Save me, save me," and there was nothing you could do.
Right. It happened many years ago in early 1987. I was in Sri Lanka, and I was with one of the guerrilla groups in Sri Lanka, the Tamil Tigers, who incidentally are still carrying on their war. And was out in this guerrilla camp that was coming in under increasing attack by the army and was about to be wiped out. And there was very much a sort of paranoid bunker mentality that set in with the Tamil Tigers, and very suspicious of me, thinking I was a spy. And they brought in this 36-year-old woman who they claimed had been a spy, a woman, a mother of six children, and who they'd been torturing, and said, "She's a spy." And they played this very perverse sort of psychological, in my opinion, psychological torture thing of basically letting my brother, who was with me, my brother and I, try to negotiate to save her life. And even though they had no intention of saving her life, and they sat her down across from us, and she spoke a little bit of English, and she knew that we were her last, very last chance to be saved, and she just begged us to try to save her. And the thing that was very difficult about that situation was that we tried by trying to negotiate, trying to reason with the rebel commander. But at a certain point, it became clear to us that we were just getting deeper into trouble. We were coming under deeper suspicion by our efforts to try to save this woman. So we had to stop. We just had to stop talking. And I mean, I always remember the moment where she was sitting about 4 feet from me, and she realized it too, and she just sort of sat back and knew it was over, and that was it.
And they shot her in front of your eyes?
No, I didn't see her execution. She was executed the next day, and then we left the camp, and then the camp itself was wiped out about a week later, and pretty much everybody there was killed. I mean, obviously, if they had tried to force us to watch her execution, I mean, I guess we would have had to have done so. But that would actually have been something I would have really resisted. I had no desire to watch it.
What was the point of them trying to get you to defend her against the charges of being a spy? Did you know her?
No. She was a local peasant woman. And apparently what had happened was the army had grabbed two of her children and also beaten her husband almost to death. I mean, and this is what happens with civilians in modern wars. I mean, they get whipsawed by both sides. A short time before, her husband had been almost beaten to death by the army, accusing him of being a Tamil tiger. And they grabbed two of her children and basically held them hostage and said, "We'll give you your kids back if you tell us what the tigers are doing in the area." And apparently, that's what she did. She was passing sort of very, very basic information on to the army in an effort to try to get her children back. The tigers found her, and so they were going to kill her. So on one hand, the army's almost murdering her husband, and on the other side, the guerrillas are murdering her.
What impact did this experience have on you?
It had a really rather profound impact. I was 28 at the time. I'd been going to war for the previous 5-6 years, and really for the first time with that incident in Sri Lanka, I think I felt complicit in it. All of a sudden, I wasn't just a bystander. I wasn't an observer. The fiction of being a just an omniscient viewer of being an outsider, that all collapsed away. And I remember feeling, I think for a very long time, well, for a very long time afterward, I never went back to a war zone. I felt that I had played a hand in her murder, and always kept playing the scene back over in my mind, trying to think of if there had been something else I could have said, something else I could have done that might have saved her.
Usually soldiers are on the battlefield either because they believe in a cause or because their government has given them no choice. They're drafted and they have to be there. But when you're a journalist and you're on the battlefield, your cause is, I guess, telling the story. Is that why you were there for that cause of telling the story? Or do you think there were other more complicated reasons that kept you in war zones for so long?
I think there's always more complicated reasons. I think a lot of, frankly, I think a lot of journalists and photographers as well, they use that platitude of, oh, well, it's important that the world knows what's happening, and that's why we go and cover these places, cover these wars. And I think that's ultimately, that's never really the true story. I think most people keep going back for a combination of a lot of different reasons, most of them rather unsavory. I know that for me, a huge part of it for a long time was just the excitement of it, frankly. The adrenaline blast you get by being around combat and enabled by not being a combatant and sort of the conceit that, well, because I'm not a combatant and I'm an outsider, nothing is going to happen to me. It wasn't courage as much as just stupidity of thinking you're immune to it. But I think there's something undeniably thrilling about combat, and it's something that, when you say that, it's something that people have a really hard time with, and I think most people have a very hard time admitting to that experience. And I think this is actually one reason why Vietnam vets have a very difficult time, or vets in general have a very difficult time in readjusting. It's not as simple as like the horrible things that happened to them on Okinawa or happened to them in Vietnam. It's also the excitement they had in Okinawa and in Vietnam, and how, you're a 19-year-old kid and now you're back in the States somewhere, and you're aware that the most exciting period of your life is past you. And I think it's very difficult to adjust to that. I don't know if I ever really believe very much the idea that I was there trying to educate the world on, you know, on the bad things that were happening. I mean, I think people have known for a long time that, you know, that war is a pretty bad thing. And there's just enough times when, say, a photograph or a piece of video does change history. And, you know, I think maybe writers, photographers can, I mean, their hope, maybe their, what drives them on, or the excuse that they tell themselves that, is that they're waiting for that, for the moment to sort of change history. But for the vast majority of us, it doesn't happen. It certainly hasn't happened to me. I can't think of anyone who, or any situation in a war that's somehow been ameliorated or improved by my presence in it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Scott Anderson, and he's reported from many war zones over the past 15 years, and he's the author of a new novel about a war photographer, and the novel is called Triage. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott Anderson. He's a journalist who has reported from many war zones and has now written a novel about a war photographer, and the novel is called Triage. You grew up in Southeast Asian countries like South Korea, Taiwan, Indonesia during the Cold War in the 1960s. It wasn't until you were 14 that you moved to the United States. What kind of work did your father do that brought you to Southeast Asia?
He was an agricultural advisor for the American government, for branch of the State Department called the Agency for International Development. And at that time, it's quite different now, but at that time, South Korea and Taiwan were basically considered underdeveloped countries. And he was primarily involved in setting up agricultural cooperatives.
So in what sense did those experiences bring you closer to the sense of war?
Certainly in Taiwan, where I spent the most amount of time, 5 years, and it was from 1963 to 1968, at the time when the Vietnam War was very much escalating, and Taiwan became both an R&R stop for GIs fighting in Vietnam, and a back base for the American military. That in combination with the government of Chiang Kai-shek, which kept always maintain this sort of war, this low-grade war hysteria in the air, the idea that the Red Chinese, as we called them back then, that the Red Chinese were going to come across the 90 miles of the Formosa Straits at any moment. I know one of my most distinct memories as a kid was of going to my school, the international school in Taiwan, and there was a manned anti-aircraft gun in the driveway with two Chinese soldiers with binoculars constantly scanning the skies, looking for the Red Chinese coming over the horizon. And I think that what happened with me, because there was such a military presence and such a war kind of being on the wind, I always thought it was inevitable that war was coming.
Let me stop you here. I always thought it was inevitable that war was coming too. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, in the United States, you know, in the 50s and 60s, during the Cold War. We had the air raid drills where you hide under your desk in case of a nuclear bomb. Grew up with constant war movies, you know, mostly World War II movies, mm-hmm. on television. And I always thought war was inevitable. I was always preparing for the nuclear weapon. But I was terrified of it. To me, this was like the worst nightmare imaginable. The last thing in the world I would have wanted to do, or that I'd want to do now, is be in a war zone. And I'm wondering if we're both kind of like part of the kind of girl-boy stereotype here, and you kind of want to get closer to me, toward me thinking like, wow, it's the worst thing imaginable, or whether, you know, something else is in play here.
Yeah, I wonder. I wonder if it's the a difference being of of just always seeing military on the streets. And at the time, Taiwan was under an official state of siege. That was the government. It was, you know, kind of beyond martial law. I don't know what it was, but I was really rather impatient for the war to just finally get there. And because I just, you know, I really wanted to see what it was going to be like.
Well, you first went to Lebanon. I mean, that was your first war zone. You went there as a stringer. You hadn't really reported from a war zone before. So what was it like to see the real thing for the first time?
Yeah, well, I actually went there trying to be a stringer. I was a failed stringer because I just couldn't find any work there. It was August of 1983, and it was the American Marines had gone in as part of the multinational, the so-called peacekeeping force there. And it was really a rather astonishing experience for me. I had been traveling through Europe for 4 or 5 months before then, just basically being a young American abroad with a backpack, and had not wanted to go home. And somebody said, "Well, you know, you can find stringing work." So I went to Beirut, and the level of fighting at that point was just starting to escalate. The American embassy had been blown up a few months before, and the Marines in Beirut were getting shot. Shot at. It was just before the Marine compound out by the airport was blown up. And I think to me the moment when I really realized just what I'd gotten myself into was, and going back to the idea of what soldiers represented to me as a kid, and I'd always sort of wanted to be a soldier, and then to be in Beirut and to talk to some of the Marines, and these were 18, 19-year-old kids, and absolutely terrified. They didn't know why they were there. They were getting shot at. They just wanted to get out. And the whole concept that I'd always had of soldiers of being sort of brave and fearless, and the sort of Hollywood idea of what it's like, was just very quickly stripped away. And I mean, these guys just wanted to get the hell out.
Journalist Scott Anderson, whose new novel is called Triage. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Columbia Records, presenting the new self-titled album from John Mellencamp featuring Your Life Is Now, available in stores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation about war with journalist and novelist Scott Anderson. Also, journalist Nina Burley talks about her new biography of Mary Meyer, one of JFK's lovers while he was president.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Scott Anderson. He's reported from many war zones around the world. Now he's written a new novel called Triage, about a photojournalist who's wounded in war. When we left off, we were talking about Anderson's early experiences reporting from war zones. What kind of risk did you take on early in your reporting experiences when you felt immune, when you felt like this immune bystander?
Mm-hmm. Well, really stupid ones, because I really did have this idea. I think this is why it's the old cliche of why you make 18-year-olds soldiers rather than 25 or 30-year-olds, because on this some deep core level, you fundamentally don't believe you're going to die. And I think it was very much that same way with me. So I would get into situations, and it started in Beirut, where bullets were popping around me, or there'd be a firefight going on, and I would rush down to get as close as I could to the firefight. And it was just basic stupidity, just assuming that nothing was going to happen to me. And that changed the more I experienced it, the more I went back to wars. I started becoming much more cautious. And it's funny that the last real war I was in was Chechnya, about 2.5 years ago, and went with this 22-year-old guy who was acting as my translator, interpreter. And I saw so much of him, of me, of 15 years earlier, really rather oblivious to danger, just as I had been, and just not picking up on clues and or appreciating just how scary the place was.
You had an article in Harper's about a year ago about your war journalism experiences, and in that you wrote, this was after having been to a lot of war zones. You wrote, "I had walked through killing fields and felt human bones break beneath my feet. I had picked up the skulls of murdered children and rearranged them with an eye to photographic composition. I had cajoled or intimidated or charmed scores of people into revealing their most intimate horrors, and then I had thanked them perfunctorily and walked away." And you say that after that you felt you deserved to be punished for the things that you'd seen. Why?
I think that over time and of seeing so many rather horrific things sort of taking place in front of me, there developed almost certainly a sense of guilt at it. And I think that the guilt manifested as something that in fact I should be punished for. And I think that, you know, we were talking about how the sort of myths of why people keep going back, why reporters, why photographers keep going back to war zone. Over time, those myths just didn't work for me anymore. And when I would see awful things, my inability to do anything to help a situation made me feel complicit in the situation, and made me feel that, you know, I mean, I wasn't there as a relief worker or as a doctor. I wasn't doing anything fundamentally to help anyone. I mean, what was I doing? I was writing about, you know, people being killed, and, you know, people were reading it, and I mean, that was it. I just wasn't doing. There wasn't a hell of a lot of good reason for me to be there. And I think after a time, I felt that my complete impotence in those places was just something that deserved to be punished.
I guess I do believe, though, that it is really important for people outside of the war zone to understand what is at stake, what's being fought about, who's being killed and why, what's being lost and why. I mean, didn't you feel that was important?
I did, and I do now. I mean, I think it's, you know, when you're looking at Kosovo right now, I think it's absolutely vital that people report on what's happening there. I think it's vital that that photographers take photos of these elderly people who are being murdered, because otherwise, I mean, if you look at Kosovo in particular, this is a conflict that the American government and a lot of other governments around the world would just love to just ignore altogether. And it's because reporters are going there and writing about it, and photographers are there taking photographs, that they're not able to do that. And I think that's a very good thing. But I think that doing that for the people who go and do that, which I have been one on occasion, it extracts its own price. And I think it's over time I realized what a price it was extracting.
So do you feel you finally were punished for what you'd seen?
I don't know if I was punished. I was certainly, I think I finally got spooked. when I was in Chechnya, which was the last really bad place I was in, I think that I got myself into situations where I finally realized, man, you can't keep doing this, that you're sort of going on borrowed time. And I think certainly when I'm in a war zone, I'm incredibly superstitious, as I think most journalists are, most soldiers are. You develop a set of superstitions of things that keep you safe, and also a way of explaining when things go bad. And one of the standard superstitions is once you lose your nerve, once you get spooked, that's when bad things happen to you. And I think that kind of happened to me in Chechnya.
Was there an experience that brought that on?
Kind of a series of experiences. I was writing a story about a man who had disappeared there, an American relief worker who had disappeared there about 6 months earlier. And it was an area of Chechnya Chechnya, right off the bat, was a really probably the most terrifying war zone I'd ever been to. And then the area of the country where he disappeared was even worse. And, you know, the idea that I was over there snooping around trying to find out who had actually killed or disappeared this man, just sort of, it just seemed like the danger level was multiplying exponentially. And there were a series of incidents, but on both sides, both with the Chechen rebels and with the Russian soldiers, where I and the people I was with, I think were incredibly lucky to have gotten out.
It seems, from having read some of your work, it seems that in some ways you think that the historical, religious, and political explanations of war strike you as almost beside the point. You seem to think it's in man's nature to go to war, and that there's just always going to be wars, no matter what we do, no matter how we explain them.
Right. Both beside the point and kind of dangerous in their own way, I feel. The explanations and the focus on causes of war. Because I think that it ends up very quickly being both a rationalization for war, and then often in situations a rationalization for doing nothing. For instance, in the case of Bosnia, you know, very quickly the history and history being another form of mythology, the mythology that attached to Bosnia was that, oh, well, these people have been in each other's throats for centuries. And that became its own, the so-called history of the Balkans became its own reason for not doing anything. On another level, I think that the danger of offering explanations of why war happens, it tends to legitimize it. I think I've developed this sort of very cynical, but I think in a way it's sort of a healthily cynical attitude towards why war happens. And I think often it's just a case of a bunch of guys, usually guys, almost always guys, almost always young, who've just... It's the most exciting thing they can think to do. It's a lot more interesting than like working the family rice paddy, and it's a lot more interesting than sitting around watching reruns in your council flat in West Belfast.
Your next book is about Fred Cuny, the global relief worker who built a water purification system in Bosnia during the war, went to Chechnya, and as you described, was lost there, and then finally, after a long search, presumed dead. I'm wondering if you felt in some ways that he was a kindred spirit in the sense that he spent a good deal of his life in war zones.
Yeah, although he spent his time in war zones actually doing something good. An amazing man, had spent 25 years dealing both with natural and man-made disasters, which is another way of saying war, and had really done just astonishing stuff, projects around the world, as you mentioned, the Water Project in Sarajevo, which really saved, at a very crucial moment, saved the city of Sarajevo from falling when the Serbs cut off the water supply. He went to Chechnya once, was there very briefly, found it a really horrifying place, but came back to the States and refused to let this war just fall off the world's consciousness, and then went back, and on when he went back, disappeared very quickly, disappeared within a day of getting back. I think that I felt a... it was interesting in writing about him that also, I think also, even for someone like Fred Kuhne, war had that same very complex sets of lures for him. Certainly, along with him was compassion, a desire to save people, to improve their lives. But there was also the excitement side of it. And here was a guy who had spent a quarter of a century zipping around from one disaster zone to the next. And I think that there was a quality of, as time went on, the excitement level, the thrill level, drew him to worse and worse places, and he finally found the very worst place, which was Chechnya. And as did I, he unfortunately didn't come back. I did, but I think I kind of crossed some little threshold with that whole experience.
Scott Anderson, thank you very much, and I trust that you're not headed back into a war zone now.
Not anytime soon.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Scott Anderson has written a new novel called Triage. Coming up, a new book about one of JFK's secret lovers. This is Fresh Air. As Congress prepares for impeachment hearings, a new book has just been published about Mary Pinchot Meyer, who was one of JFK's secret lovers while he was in the White House. The Secret Service locked her in on 17 evenings. The affair coincided with the heating up of the Cold War. According to the book, Meyer was with Kennedy on the night he went on TV to warn the American people about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mary Pinchot Meyer was shot to death less than a year after Kennedy's assassination. Yesterday was the 34th anniversary of her murder. It's still unsolved. The new book about Meyer is called A Very Private Woman. My guest is the author, Nina Burley. She's an editor at New York Magazine and a former reporter for Time Magazine. Nina Burley says, historically, people are interested in mistresses to find out what they reveal about famous men. Burley was interested in the impact of Kennedy on Meyer's life. I asked Burley if she thought the affair between Meyer and Kennedy was just sexual, or if they were close friends as well.
I think that they were very close and that the sexual part of the relationship was somewhat secondary. And I think that they were friends before being lovers and that they were also friends after they became lovers.
Did Jackie Kennedy know about it?
That's a good question. The women that I talked to who were close to Mary and also were part of the circle of people, women who were kind of having occasional flings with the president, said that they never really knew how much Jackie knew about the other women in her husband's life, but that she seemed to be kind of acquiescing to at least having women around who her husband liked. And in one case, for example, I interviewed a woman who had had a fling with Kennedy, and she recalls that Jackie seated her on one side of Kennedy and Mary on the other side at a White House dinner. And so the feeling that I got from this was that Jackie had a very sort of sophisticated attitude, if you will, towards her husband's behavior, and that she felt perhaps that he needed to be allowed these dalliances. Now, whether she knew that they were actually having sex together, I cannot answer.
Mary Meyer had been married to a man who was in the CIA, the man who you describe as being most famous for being the brains behind the CIA's infiltration of American student organizations. Did that make the CIA, do you think, any more or less interested in monitoring her relationship with Kennedy?
I think that it probably didn't have that much effect on their interest in her as a romantic interest of the president's, because I think that the intelligence community was interested in any women that he, the president, had a relationship with.
And what were their concerns?
Well, I would think the first concern was always blackmail. And then the second concern would be that these women were uncontrollable, that they might be answering to other men, or that they might be telling other men things about Kennedy, or that they might be giving Kennedy, lobbying Kennedy sort of in bed. I think that they feared these women to some extent.
Your interest in the story isn't just an interest in, you know, a presidential affair. You're interested in who Mary Meyer was as a person. You're interested in her in her own right. So I'd like you to tell us a little bit about who she was as a person. I mean, some of the things that, define her is that she was an artist. She experimented with Reichian therapy. She was a friend of Timothy Leary's and was likely to have taken LSD in its experimental phase. I mean, you describe her as someone who went from a fairly conventional, you know, suburban wife type of role to, after her marriage, becoming much more adventurous.
Yes, to some extent you're right about that, but I think that she was born to a family, the Pinchot family in Pennsylvania, a very wealthy, somewhat bohemian family that appreciated skepticism and had certain strain of radicalism, actually. I mean, her father, Amos Pinchot, was a founder of the American Progressive Party, and actually split off from the Progressive Party because he was too radical, because he was too much of a trust buster. And so she was raised and her mother was also rather unconventional. Her mother wrote for The Nation and was, a working woman in the 1920s when that wasn't always that common. Lived in Greenwich Village and was very close with Max Eastman. And so Mary grew up in a household that sort of was more skeptical and more bohemian maybe than let's say Jackie did, although they were of the same class. So she started out more likely to be a kind of an experimental woman.
Now, the story of Mary Meyer's death not only figures into the story of John F. Kennedy's behavior in the White House, it figures into the conspiracy theories about JFK. How does it relate to those theories?
Well, she was murdered just a few weeks after the Warren Commission report came out. So those who see a conspiracy here see that as significant timing. That's one way that it's related. The other is that she was married to a top CIA official. She had been divorced from Cord Meyer before she and Kennedy got together, but she was still in touch with Cord Meyer, and Cord Meyer certainly was in the loop on things like the Castro assassination plots and So she would have, those who believe that there may be a conspiracy here think that she was aware of some of these CIA secrets, that she would have been aware of them via her husband, and that knowing her politics, knowing her sort of roguish, experimental lifestyle, certainly in terms of the more conventional Georgetown wives whom she was friendly with, she may have been ready to tell these stories. And that's what the conspiracy people believe, that she just knew more than she was supposed to.
Do you buy any of that?
I think that she probably knew more than the average American wife, and maybe knew more than the average woman in Washington. But was she in on the assassination plot, if there was such a plot to assassinate Kennedy? I seriously doubt it. I don't think that that Kennedy certainly was telling her state secrets. So I don't buy that she knew things that would have led to her being killed that day.
My guest is journalist Nina Burley. Her new book about Mary Meyer is called A Very Private Woman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, journalist Nina Burley, is the author of a new biography of Mary Meyer, who was one of JFK's lovers while he was in the White House. Just after Mary Meyer was found murdered, her good friend Ann Truitt called Meyer's sister, Toni Bradley, who was then the wife of Ben Bradley, editor of the Washington Post. She had called to tell Toni Bradley about Mary Meyer's diary. What did she want her to know about the diary?
She wanted Toni to know that there might be material in the diary that would be embarrassing and that Mary would have preferred it not to be made public.
And what happened to the diary?
Well, that's a good question. The night after the murder, the Bradleys and counterintelligence chief James Angleton and perhaps some other people found the diary in Mary Meyer's studio. James Angleton took the diary along with a box of letters and papers, basically all of the written material that recorded her life, took it to the CIA. And he called certain people, including one of Mary's lovers, a man named Kenneth Nolan, an artist, and said he had destroyed the letters that Ken Noland and Mary Meyer had exchanged. And he then told people that he had disposed of the diary, at least Ben Bradley thought he had. And then a few years later, he presented it to Toni Bradley, who by this time was divorced from Ben. And Toni, according to Ann Truitt, burned the diary in the presence of some of her friends and Mary's friends. Other information that I got after that was told to me indicate that the diary may actually still exist in the Milford, Pennsylvania family home of the Pinchos. But they did not concede that, and they did not make it available to me. So I have to assume it's either burned or locked away at the Pennsylvania estate.
What do you think was in the diary?
I think that Ben Bradley described it. It was an artist's sketchbook with lots of colors in it and some writing, and it recorded her meetings with Kennedy. And I'm not sure how she recorded them, but she certainly made it clear to a reader like Ben Bradley that she was having a romantic relationship with the president.
How has writing this book about the affair between Mary Meyer and JFK affected your thoughts about whether President Clinton should be impeached?
When I consider the notion of President Clinton being impeached over his relationship with Monica Lewinsky and the lies that he apparently told about it, I can't help but think about all of the literature that is now available and all of the gate logs that are available at the JFK Library that prove that Kennedy was engaged in far more reckless behavior with women than what we know President Clinton was engaged in. And for that reason, I find it ridiculous that we have gotten to this pass. As a woman, I am offended by both of their behaviors, and that I think that the women who were involved with Kennedy were used, and they feel used now, those who are still living, when they think back on it, and that that relationship with Kennedy was damaging to these women. And I think that it's going to be the same for Monica Lewinsky and any other women who may have had relationships with President Clinton. As a feminist, I'm put in a bad position because I find it abhorrent that these women were treated this way. But at the same time, I think back to, 35 years ago, and a president that is revered in American history who was engaged in the same kind of behavior.
Nina Burley, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Nina Burley's new biography of Mary Meyer is called A Very Private Woman. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Alan, too, directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publisher of the Breast Cancer Prevention Diet, the powerful foods, supplements, and drugs that can save your life by Dr. Bob Arnott in bookstores, and Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape of the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences, in bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer Teddy Pendergrass. His new autobiography describes his life before and after the 1982 car accident that left him a quadriplegic. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.